define the guy uses a Hegelian argument to argue against Hegel. You find the same thing in Kierkegaard, even the late Kierkegaard. Many of his writings, you can see the thesis, antithesis, synthesis, development going there. So one of the characteristics of the Hegelian method is, in order to understand what something is, you do a genetic analysis of it. You ask, where did it come from? How did we get it? What did it develop out of? You write a kind of genetic history on the topic. Now, we're all familiar with that in biology, in geology, because this has been the pattern for about the last 100 years of the way that biology and geology are done. We're not particularly familiar with it in other kinds of disciplines. Well, in Nietzsche, in his writings, primary writings from the Gestalt period, The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music, what Nietzsche does is do a genetic history of how the art developed. And it has this particular advantage that it enables us to see relationships of the art to one another, and it enables us to see characteristics of a particular art as it is being practiced at a particular kind of time. And so from this standpoint, it's kind of helpful, as well as being very interesting itself. We're talking aesthetics this morning, and so some of the terms get defined a little bit differently than they did yesterday, when really I was talking philosophical ontology, or what used to be called metaphysics. If we were talking aesthetically about Nietzsche's three periods today, I suppose we could say the first period is his classical period, second period is his romantic period, the third period is his naturalistic period. His first period, carrying on from what he had come to him from the past. His second period, his evolutionary period, reflecting the times in which he was living. And his third period, his naturalistic period, anticipating the 20th century. There are two animating principles, according to Nietzsche, two natural animating principles in man: the Dionysian and the Apollonian. Later on, Freud would call the Dionysian the libido, he would call the Apollonian the ego principle. Those of you that are familiar with Freud know you've got a third principle that takes mankind to superego, which is an unnatural principle that develops as a result of conditioning by parents, teachers, and others. This is also in Nietzsche, and Nietzsche tends to have a very negative attitude toward it. He usually reduces it to Christian morality, that perversion which has destroyed man's natural impulses. Right, well, we have the Dionysian and the Apollonian. He calls the Dionysian the spirit of drunkenness, and the Apollonian the spirit of dreams, the dream world. Reality itself, this period of Nietzsche's development, had no meaning whatsoever. It was sheer naked energy expressing itself. It was about as meaningful as volcanoes going off in a volcanic island emerging from the seas, and with all of the lava pouring around and the spouting up in the air. Sheer chaos. No meaning, no purpose. Sheer power going off. Sheer energy going off. And so Nietzsche's view of the primordial universe is the notion of simply energy going off. Action and reaction going off, with no meaning or sense to it whatsoever. It settles down, it seems to fall into meaningful patterns, and then all of a sudden there's a hurricane and there's destruction all over the place. And we start over again. You have a magnificent mountain valley with a lovely lake surrounded by a beautiful balsam forest, and you get a heavy snowfall, and all of a sudden, whoosh, you know, you got 500 pine trees smashed down. Those of you that have been holding Holden Lake know what I'm talking about. No meaning. no purpose, sheer destruction. This is the way nature is. Man has this kind of impulse within himself also because he is a natural object. The libidinal impulse is blind, wild, it has no meaning, no purpose, it simply lashes out. It is a kind of survival principle, but it is a kind of survival principle which oftentimes is its own worst enemy. Freud argued that this was the reason why the ego principle emerged, to save the psyche, to save the organism, because the libidinal impulse was a willy-nilly kind of impulse which could just as well destroy the organism as preserve it. And so the ego develops as the self-preservative kind of principle because the libido is irrational. So the dimension principle is this violent principle of creative energy which is uncontrolled and oftentimes uncontrollable. It produces the universe, it produces the burgeoning varieties of life with which we are surrounded, and it is the motivating principle of man. I mean that quite literally. It is the principle that moves man. It's like the gasoline in the engine that causes the vehicle to move. So if one's libidinal energies are low, one is suffering from cold and flu, one doesn't move around very much. One is rather lethargic. When one's libidinal energies are really going, one decides he's going to walk through Seattle Pass and back in one day. And when he gets back, in libidinal energies are down again. And so this rises and falls in us. In a sheer energy, it's the difference between the guy like me that needs 8 or 9 hours sleep and a guy like Carol that can get by on 4 or 5. There's more energy there. Well, anyway, this is the Dionysian. If a work of art does not have the Dionysian in it, it's dead. It's really not a work of art. It's just a work of, I should say, it's an artistic work. If it's lacking in the Dionysian, it's dead. It has no vitality. It's just a product. On the other hand, we have the Apollonian principle. The Apollonian principle is the principle of organization. But beyond this, it's also the principle of imagination. When one is strong in the Apollonian principle, he's a poet. He's an artist. He has an imagination that is constantly flowing with ideas. He sees the natural stuff of nature lying around, exhibiting no purpose and meaning, and he puts it together meaningfully. And Nietzsche talks about the Apollonian spirit as the spirit of dreams, because we dream our dreams, and then with the stuff of reality, we fashion them and make them concrete. And you can see already in Nietzsche the beginning of Freud's dream psychology. In order to understand what makes a man tick, you study his dreams. Because his dreams are the expression of his organizing principles. They're the expression of his uniqueness. And you can see from a study of his dreams how his mind works, what his hang-ups are, what his problems are, and where his frustrations are. So these are the two basic principles with which we operate. The Dionysian principle and the Apollonian principle both come from the Greeks. Dionysus was the god of growth. His festival in the springtime was set at the time when the Greeks were reasonably sure that the new wine was ready. And they drank a lot of wine in connection with Festival of Dionysus. And the Festival of Dionysus was a music festival, because music was the expression of Dionysus. On the other hand, Apollo is the god of reason. Apollo is the patron of all of the arts. The nine muses work for him. He is the sun god, and the sun gives order purpose to the universe. So you have these two principles that are operative in the universe, operative in mankind. The Dionysian tends to be a principle which sometimes is under control and then it bursts out, and then it gets under control again and it bursts out. And this is how the history of the universe is created. The ancient Greeks thought of the Dionysian principle as exhibiting itself in mankind under a variety of forms. Nietzsche mentioned the one, drunkenness. When a man is in his cup, the Apollonian restraint fall aside, and he behaves quite libidinally until he passes out. Another expression of Dionysius is falling in love. And lovers are Dionysian figures. This is why when they want to get married, it's so hard for mom and dad to convince them that this isn't too smart at this time, and why don't they wait a year or something like that. You get absolutely nowhere because they're not under the guidance of Apollo, they're under the Dionysian impulse. Thirdly, insanity. The Greeks were one of the few people who looked upon insanity as a blessing rather than as a curse, because they thought that a person who was insane had been touched by the gods. Matter of fact, they would sit and listen to them talk because they felt that they might get some special insight from the gods. And so insanity, a person who was insane was a person who was under the control of Dionysius. Theological inspiration, the fourth variety, exemplified by the priestesses at Delphi who breathed in the helium gases coming from the orifices of the earth, and then they began to babble as they sat on their stools breathing in the helium and quite intoxicated, and other people then would interpret their babbling and report outside what the message was. And finally, the artist, the creative artist, particularly the poet, the dramatist, touched by the gods, inspired by the gods to bring a message to man. Under the ecstatic fever of creative production, he served Apollo by producing a disciplined work of art, but he also serves Dionysius, who gives him his creative energy. All right, so if you'll now think of the universe is very much in a state of flux, and all these blind, wild forces interacting with one another, producing a universe which has no purpose, it just simply comes into being, ordered as it may be, simply comes into being. Somewhere way back there was a human being who began to express his libidinal energy musically. He may have done it by going, oh, or, oh, or something like that. But at any rate, music came into being as a spontaneous expression of the Dionysian in man. And many people think that natural music is simply the pre-vocal expression of the libidinal impulse. So anyway, we have music coming into being. Not music as we know it from Bach, Mozart, and so on. It's way down the path. But pure natural music arising out of man's nature. Any reaction to this, we get the emergence of the verbal. And in its earliest art form, we get the folk tale. And what is the folk tale? The folk tale is an effort on the part of a primitive people to preserve the memory of a great event. either of a great disruptive event which had great significance for the community, or a salvation type event. And so we get the myth, the folk tale. And when we merge music and the folk tale, we get the lyric poem, which is the earliest form of poetry, the lyric poem. Or today we say the folk song. I think it's important to notice, and we've talked in this as a parenthetical idea. I think it is extremely important to notice that native to our culture at this very time, and extremely important, perhaps more important than any other art form, is the folk song. And it's a very early form, and it reflects a characteristic of the culture where the Dionysian is extremely strong and the Apollonian is relatively weak. In other words, there's a tremendous amount of energy going on. There's a tremendous amount of tension, and there is a thin restraint, a thin control. But we now get, after this, the development of epic poetry. Epic poetry is the taking of a number of folk tales and merging them into a unity by means of relating them to a character. So we have the invention of character as a dramatic device. You create the hero. You do a longer story now, whose primary function and whose principle of unity is to exhibit the character of the hero. You have Odysseus, the Odyssey, which is an exhibition of the hero, Odysseus, and beyond this, the expression of the Dionysian wandering of man, of adventuresome man. So we get the epic poem emerging. Now, I said before that this is Hegelian. Now, you can exhibit also that it's Hegelian by virtue of the fact that we get, first of all, a Dionysian form emerging, music. In reaction to this, we get an Apollonian form emerging, the folk tale, wherein events are imprisoned and disciplined under the form of language. When we get music at this particular point, we don't just simply have something like this, but we get and we got a beat and we got a tune, and it's 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and we have imprisoned it between bars. We've got, nowadays anyway, we've got 5 horizontal bars, and we've got those measure bars, which are the prism, the Apollonian prism, within which we have captured the Dionysian. You see, we are beginning to domesticate the artistic spirit. When we get to epic poetry, we've got an even more sophisticated kind of thing, because we are now operating with a large unity, which is rather complicated. We are dealing with the creation of a character. We are not simply taking the Dionysian and imprisoning it or repeating it or something like that, but we are literally creating a structure. We are now going three-dimensional. We've got a prison which is a birdcage. And we've got the Dionysian imprisoned within it, and it floats freely within the three-dimensional structure. We have exhibited a full-blown character. What came next was the development of Doric art. The Doric art represents a purely Apollonian reaction now to epic poetry. We have the invention of the Doric column. I should say we have the invention of the column. It is now possible to throw up high buildings with high-blown roofs. It is possible, before we had hovels now we can build temples. Man is now beginning to reach for the stars by means of his intellectual capacity, his capacity to organize. And so he produces an age the high point of which is the Parthenon, which is the epitome of Doric art and also the pure expression of it. Now, Nietzsche makes an interesting little aside about the Parthenon, which I want to make some comments about, because it's quite important. One of the things which emerged in epic poetry which was not there before was what Nietzsche called a Greek invention. Now, we know it's not a Greek invention today because other people had it also. But he said, the genius of the Greek people produced the solution to save man from the horror of pure existence. The Greeks produced a mythology. They invented gods. And the gods developed out of the ancient myth. They developed a whole panoply of gods. And if you read Greek epic poetry, you find the very important actors in the story are the gods and goddesses. They interact with mankind. They save mankind, they destroy mankind, depending on who they're for and who they're against. But they're extremely important. And Nietzsche says the gods function like a buffer between man and the horror of existence, and they give meaningfulness to life. You read Hesiod's Theogony, and you see each one of the gods has a function. There's the god of the earth, there's the god of time, there's the god of timelessness, there's the god of love, there's the god of war, and so on. Each one of these has a particular function. And their interaction with one another gives us our prehistory, explains how the universe came into being, what principles are operative in it, and makes sense out of existence. It's kind of primordial science, theological science. And the Greeks invented this, he says. And it is exhibited in Doric culture. How? It's exhibited this way. You look at the Parthenon. See, it's up on the high hill. And the Parthenon is like this. And you've got columns going all around here. What do you have, and people are down here. See, what do you have here and all the way around here? You have the frieze. Most of which today is in the British Museum, thanks to Lord Elgin buying it from the Greeks before they knew any better. The acts of the gods. This is the Greek mythology, and it serves as the roof over man's head to protect him from the wild elements. And so the Parthenon represents the high point of Doric culture, where we have, by virtue of principles of architecture, we are able to rear this high building. We're able to provide a shelter for mankind, whereby he is literally protected from the elements, and theologically he's protected from the wrath of the universe by having a place where he can sacrifice to the gods and thereby ward off disaster from himself. And we also get a perfect building, a building which is a perfect expression of peace and serenity. And so we have the antithesis to the previous one now, the emphasis upon the Apollonian. In response to this, we develop a kind of art form which is very strongly Dionysian, namely the Dionysian Festival, which begins as a choral festival celebrating the rebirth of the Dionysian principle in the spring and the return of life and the coming to fruition of the grape in wine and things of this sort. So we have the Dionysian festival where we gather the people of the community together and we celebrate Dionysus. Now, I've got to draw you a picture of a Greek theater here to show you something.
the Greeks developed amphitheaters for their music festivals. And they designed them to work well. They put the seating up on the hillside, just like the ballpark down here. Those of you that have been down there and see the remains of the bleachers still sitting up on the mountainside. The Greeks did the same thing there. I'm sure it wasn't so that they could hear what the ball players said to one another very well. It wasn't for acoustical, but for visible purposes. So this was done for acoustics. All right, now what do you need for a choral festival? You need risers, right? We build risers out of marble. You need a sounding board that's hard behind. So they put a sounding board in back with short columns in front of it, and so on, okay? Giving you kind of a bad view here. You need, when you've got a big choir, as you're going to have, you got to have a number of exits where they can get out, and so they can get out this way, and they can get out this way, and you got a next big exit here, and a big exit here, and a big exit here. So you got five ways the choir can get out and get in very fast. And since this is a religious festival, what do you have to have? Obviously, you've got to have an altar. So we build an altar out here, and we allow plenty of room around it so that the priest can function. And you see, we end up then with a bowl here. So this is the Dionysian Festival Music Theater, which becomes and remains the theater as we shift to the final form, the tragic form. As we shift from music, the music festival, to the dramatic festival, we retain the same theater. But we have a theater which was designed for music festivals and it's used for art. And it isn't, well, the latest of the dramatic people introduced scenery so that they could have change of scene. For all practical purposes, the theater remains largely unchanged until you get to the Latin theater, and the Latins come up with the proscenium theater, and the theater as we know it more familiarly. All right, so we then get the final form, which is the tragic form. Once again, a return to the Apollonian, because the tragedy is a statement of the nature of reality, of the predicament of mankind in a universe which is absurd and which ultimately will destroy him. And so we then get full-blown art. Now, how do we know that we've got full-blown art? Well, I'll give you a little proof here, which is not in Nietzsche, but which I think you might find interesting, particularly if you know Aristotle's Poetics. This is where Aristotle's Poetics comes in. We take the six varieties of art that emerge now. The first one is music. The third one is pure music. The second one was the myth. The third one is epic. The fourth one is Doric art or architecture. The fifth one is the festival. And the sixth one is tragedy. In the sixth chapter of Aristotle's Poetics, Aristotle says, poetry, which is the highest of the arts, contains within itself six elements, and then he ticks them off. All right, now from the first art form here, we get the element melody. With the second art form, we get diction, language. With the third art form, we get character. Aristotle says the primary characteristic of epic is character. And people mistakenly think that the primary characteristic of tragedy is character, is not. From Doric art, we get spectacle, or the visible. From the festival, we get thought. Primary attribute of thought. And then from the tragedy, we get the principle of action. Because the essence of a tragedy is you create a kind of situation which is composed of actualities and potentialities, potentiality being another word for character. If a man's character is what he is capable of being, you introduce one action and everything goes click, 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 like one shot on the pool table, and balls interact with one another, and it moves to a logical conclusion, the end result of which is the destruction of the hero in one form or another. But it moves with the logical necessity of a syllogism. Given the situation, given the character, given one act, bang, 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 and that's the way it goes. So we get action as the essence of tragedy. And this is all there are, these six. And so we have a full-blown development here. Now, several thoughts which go beyond this, and a couple more ideas, and give you a little time to react. Very little time, my watch says. In the latter part of the 19th century, one of the famous names was a rather eccentric guy who lived as a virtual recluse at Oxford University, named Walter Pater. And his most famous writing is The Renaissance, which I have attempted various times to read, including at Holden Village this time, and I got about 12 pages in, and then got involved in more important things. But at any rate, one of Pater's basic principles is what animates all of art is its attempt to return to the form of music. And I would like to suggest that as we go post-Nietzsche, that what has been happening since Nietzsche has been not only an exhibition of the kind of things he was talking about, but that there has been an effort to move in a post-tragic direction. And let me suggest several things. In other words, what we have attempted to do is to break loose from this fully developed intellectual structure of complete, determined explanation, and to free the Dionysian once again, to be Dionysian. A couple examples of this. Wagnerian opera. Think of only one Wagnerian opera, Tristan und Isolde. What happens in Tristan und Isolde? You have Tristan, who's this great Teutonic hero, and you've got Isolde, who is this wife of the king, and Tristan has to be the protector of Isolde, and they fall in love with one another, and it finally ends up in their death. And you have two great themes in Tristan and Isolde. You have the Liebeslied and the Liebestod, the love song and the love death song. If you've ever experienced Tristan and Isolde, you know what affective experiences are. Because as there's very little happening on stage, but as the drama builds, you feel as though you are simply lifted up out of yourself and you're floating in midair as this luxuriant music builds bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and you are completely captivated by the Dionysian. And you begin virtually to lose your identity, and you feel as though you are kind of merged into a greater reality that simply encompasses your own being. And it was this sort of thing that Wagner strove for, and in a sense what Wagner was trying to do was to move beyond the tragic. And certainly Tristan and Isolde is a tragedy, but there's more going on here, because neither Tristan nor Isolde are Apollonians. Tristan is this big, powerful, brute warrior, and he's not too bright. And Isolde's got a lot of libido, you know, and she's a big girl. But neither one of them would ever make it to college. They were lucky to be born in an ancient age when there weren't schools. They are dominated by the dynasty. See, and it overwhelms them. And there's nothing they can do about it, and they are destroyed by it. And Tristan is only sort of borderline a hero. And what Wagner has done is he has taken epic poetry and he's operated with very sophisticated advanced music in order to produce an art form, and he was probably most successful with Tristan and Isolde in doing this, to produce an art form that moves us beyond what Nietzsche had called the tragic. It's not a very far step from Tristan and Isolde to Easy Rider. I know whether that jars you or not. But what we have in Tristan is a borderline hero. He's almost an anti-hero. Okay? And it doesn't take push, but a little more push. And you make your protagonist a little less Apollonian, and all of a sudden you get the anti-hero. Okay? The guy who is motivated by his gut. And we've had one guy who's been a borderline anti-hero around for almost 2 decades and didn't know it because we were so busy talking about the anti-hero in literature and the anti-hero in movies and so on. And for almost 2 decades, we have had Matt Dillon, who is a real Dionysian character ever, if there ever was one, except where it comes to Kitty, you know, and it kind of ebbs whenever Kitty's around, otherwise they'd long ago had an affair or gotten married. But you're in an almost purely Dionysian situation. Watch Gunsmoke, and you get back to all the glories of civilization, you know, including Gunsmoke.
That's the one thing I do.
Is it? But watch Gunsmoke, just for the sake of Nietzsche, and you'll be amazed as I was as we were coming out here one evening, Gunsmoke was on in the motel, and we put it on. I wanted to see what had happened since the last time I watched about 8 years ago. And it is amazing the amoral situation which is there. It's a completely amoral situation. And you have Dionysian impulses battling one another. And some people get destroyed. And you feel sorry about it. And nobody's bad and nobody's good. It's just that's the way it is. See? And we are what I would call beyond the Greeks. We have moved beyond the tragic notion into the kind of borderline world of near irrationality. And this is the direction that a lot of art has gone in the creation of the anti-hero. The Dionysian figure, the amoral being who lives by sheer gut. And this is about where we are today in a great many respects. And what we are doing in much of music, what we are doing in much of drama and in literature, is we are almost consciously doing violence to our perfect structure in order to free the Dionysian to be itself, in order to be authentic. One final thought. Nietzsche saw the tragedy, the Greek tragedy, as the salvation of mankind. Aristotle had said that the function of the tragedy is cathartic, to free man of the feelings of fear and pity, two weakening feelings which tend to soften a man. You cannot fight against a hostile universe if you're standing there wiping your eyes as you bawl. And you cannot fight a hostile universe and survive if you're scared stiff of living itself. You have to find a cave where you can hide and retreat. So consequently, Aristotle said, the tragedy was created in order that people could experience under control conditions in the amphitheater, they could experience this feeling of utter helplessness in the face of a meaningless universe which was totally indifferent to the goodness of the hero and destroyed him anyway. And they could feel those cold, empty, hopeless feelings. And they could also feel deeply moved by the plight of the hero and be overcome by this and have themselves a good cry if they wanted. And having experienced these, it was now for a time impossible for them to experience these feelings, because having once had a feeling, it takes a while before your psyche gets re-geared to have the feeling again. So for a period of time, they were now incapable of those kinds of feelings and now had renewed strength to go back to life and keep on living. So Nietzsche saw this as the way that the Greeks discovered salvation for mankind. In the development of the tragedy, out of this primordial Dionysian impulse, and in the tragedy, the tragedian exhibited a Dionysian universe which ultimately destroys Apollonian man, and where he is able to survive for a while by his wit, by his Apollonian spirit, but ultimately he gets overcome. And so what is important in life then becomes not whether you overcome or are overcome, but how, when inevitably being overcome occurs the way that you need it. And that's Nietzsche. About 2 minutes before I send you over to enjoy the delights of Beanie's lecture in the Village Center. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that more. Comment on that. All right, you'll be back in at 11:10, and a lot of these things are coming in once again. Another characteristic, I don't want to steal any thunder from Norm's discussion at 11:10, but, you know, Carol's been talking rather than gone about the plight of the intellectual today, and there's no question about it. The plight of the intellectual is, in Nietzschean terms, is the fact that at the time in which we're living, it's a strongly Dionysian time. And the more Apollonian a person is, the more intellectual he is, the more disciplined he is, the less popular he is, and the more difficult it is for his art to survive, because we're very strongly gut-oriented these days. And, of course, the big fear is that we can go into the opposite extreme and become extremely rationalistic as a reaction to what's going on right now. In the social field, you know, it's the fear of the right-wing law and order people who want to reduce life to rule-following, period. Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't speak to
Bruce. How does it fit in with him? Yeah. Well, oh sure. As a matter of fact, you can take some good Greek philosophy and say, well, maybe that's what Paul is saying to those Corinthian Greeks. One of the characteristics of the post-Aristotelian Greeks that weren't Platonists was a belief that ultimately we'd be able to make sense out of everything. Interestingly, in reaction to this, what came as the most dominant philosophical movement out of the Platonic school was skepticism. And a belief that, you know, that man's reason doesn't avail for anything. So I think there's kind of a double thing going on there on the part of Paul. Number one, he's talking to their cultural heritage and saying, look, you Greeks have a tendency to feel that this is going to solve it all. And there's not going to solve it all, and you certainly aren't going to put God in a box. And so here he is. We now have God in our birdcage. Look at him. We've got him all figured out.
There's a good image for you, Carol, when you talk about you can't reduce theology to philosophy. You can't put God in the birdcage. And so this is the one side. And he does have support. I mean, they can recognize this also as part of their Greek heritage, is a recognition of the limitations of human reason. On the other hand, he's saying, look, you know, you're Greeks, you're rationalists, you believe in the reason of man. It's not that good. God's thoughts aren't your thoughts, and you aren't going to think your way into eternity, into heaven.
You have to give Paul a credit that you can't believe you're Luke. You can't even go follow the Bible.
Right.
And Luke is what he's identified by no reason, a follow, or will, or straight back into the
Spirit. Right, that's right.
Not to Jesus Christ in the Lord of Jesus. And the Holy Spirit has spoken to you about it.
Right. And he breaks in.
But this kind of a dialectic is true. He's seen a second position where you understand any time and any situation, including your own home, your own life, your own lifestyle. And I can appreciate this. We're taking this last hour of whether it's in Jesus.
Okay, I shouldn't keep you any longer because Dean is waiting to go a bit Dionysian with you liturgically. Yeah, thank you, Bill.